From the Hamilton Spectator, this is the story of Diane Rowendowitz, a 23-year-old woman who was killed on her way home from a Stony Creek bar in 1981, and Robert Badgerow, the Hamilton steelworker who has been tried 4 times for her murder. That's the sound of pounds of files landing on a desk in the Hamilton Spectator newsroom. One is marked Ravine Rapist, another Diane Rowendowitz. Some are labeled DNA and phone booth. But most are titled Robert Badgerow, after the Hamilton steelworker who was the first person in Canada to be tried 4 times for the same first-degree murder. Those files, along with hundreds of Spectator stories, dozens of photographs, and an ebook, have chronicled the history of this case since it began on a warm summer night in 1981.
This creek right here, just off of busy Lake Avenue, you can hear it in the background. This is the spot where the body of Diane Rowendowitz was found 36 years ago.
This is right now with the creek running through, I guess what used to be just a ravine, but it has been converted into a park now. There's a children's playground and some picnic tables. And you can see we're at this bend in the creek, and there's this this kind of iconic at this point tree hanging over the water where Diane's body was found.
Yeah, Diane was just 22 years old. She was a nursing assistant at McMaster Hospital, and a bunch of kids who lived in those apartment buildings right there, they were out playing here in the ravine when they found her. She was face down in this shallow water, partially clothed, and there was a big tire, like a truck tire, placed on top of her head. And when police removed the truck tire, they found that her own purse, the straps, were wrapped tightly around her neck. She had been strangled and drowned. And later, it was learned that she had been raped before she was murdered.
Few other Hamilton crime cases have captured the city's attention like this one. Perhaps because it went unsolved for so long, or maybe because DNA science finally cracked it open, or because of countless fascinating legal twists and turns, or maybe because Robert Badgerow still, to this day, maintains his innocence. The Spectator has been telling this story from the very beginning, from the discovery of Diane's body through an unprecedented 4 trials in a case running 36 years and counting. The newspaper has not only in some sense owned the Badgerow story, it has, at times, become a part of it. And like the case itself, the journalism behind the Badgerow saga is fascinating. My name is David Crosby, and I'm a web editor at the Hamilton Spectator. This is Covering Diane, a Spectator serial podcast about nearly 4 decades of coverage of one murder.
So these are some of my files on the Badgerow case. This whole half of my desk is full of files, and then we have more files in the library, and all of our legal files on this would be in one of the editor's offices. So these are all just the paper files, and then I have all kinds of electronic files as well, and photos, and just like so much stuff. Sometimes I forget what I even have.
That's Susan Claremont. She's the Spec's crime and court columnist who has covered this case longer than anyone. You'll hear her voice from time to time in this podcast. She's been writing about this sexual assault and homicide since she started working here 20 years ago. But the reporting began long before Susan's days with the paper. It started in June 1981, with a summer intern named Hank Danishevsky, who is now a veteran reporter at the London Free Press.
Well, I was in the and turn at the Hamlet Spectre in 1981. And there was about 11 of us at the time. We rotated around various shifts in departments. And one of it was weekend duties. And on this particular weekend, it was just general assignment, really. It wasn't all cops. But your first job was come in and do cop checks. And at some point, I don't know if there was a release or whether, you know, something was told me directly. I ended up talking to like a desk sergeant at the Hamilton Police, and he told me about this murder. And so, you know, I said, okay, fine. And I wrote it. He only gave me the barest details, which is very common for cops even today. So I ended up talking to this cop, and it was a desk sergeant I'd never talked to before or probably never talked to afterwards. He gave me bare details. I was, you know, told to write it up. It was a pretty big case. I mean, obviously, in the beginning, but, you know, we had the bare details. And after that, I was told to do a pickup. And a pickup was a big rite of passage back in those days at the Spectator. And it was not only expected that you would pick up a picture of the dead person, but it was kind of, you know, specifically given to summer students as a rite of passage to sort of prove how tough you were. I hated it. You know, I mean, I thought it was an awful job, especially under the circumstances where this young woman was, you know, raped and murdered. And you know, on this was Father's Day. I mean, the irony, I had to go speak to her parents. And, but, you know, you had to do it. And so I remember distinctly showing up at their apartment building, knocking at the door, and I was just shaking because you don't know what reaction you're going to get in a situation like that. But then this fellow came to the door, her father, you know, sort of short, swarthy fellow. When he came out, he was very polite. He just said, you know, he wasn't confrontational at all. I said, come on in and talk. And we sat at his kitchen table. And as I recall, as we came in, I saw a woman lying on the couch in the living room, sort of with her back to me. And he explained, well, that's my wife. She was very upset. She took some pills and was trying to get some sleep. Okay, so we sat at the kitchen table and we talked. And, you know, I tried to get whatever further details I could get out of him about what he knew about the case and about his daughter, just his standard stuff. And as I said, he was quite polite, and a couple times he kind of broke down, sort of emotionally. But then he, you know, composed himself. I remember there were a couple of key questions I asked. Like the one I struggled with over the years was that I can't remember, was it? Her birthday the following day. It was Father's Day and it was her birthday the following day or something like that. And I thought, well, the editors are going to want me to ask, even though it's kind of a tasteless question, I'm going to have to ask, what did you get her for her birthday? And he just sort of looked down. He says, well, I don't know. I guess we're going to get her a coffin. You know. And I just didn't know how to deal with that, with the quote about getting her a coffin, because I just thought, this is getting too personal. This is exploiting their grief just too closely. And, but then afterwards he said something else. There was a crucifix or a religious picture over his shoulder. And I thought, oh, well, you know, are you a man of faith? Is that going to sustain you through the situation? And he sort of looked at it and he said, no, I don't believe in God. That's my wife's idea. He said, I don't believe any God would allow this to happen. In other words, what happened to his daughter. So I thought, okay, well, that's a good quote. And that it's a little less intrusive than the quote of buying her a coffin. So anyway, I went back and I wrote the story, and or a part of the story, and then it went into the first edition. There, you know, Spectator had several editions at that point, and that also got to be a bone of contention in a trial, which edition it appeared in and what was said. Anyway, and then later on, the Carlo Mastromedia, a reporter, was a part-time reporter, I believe, but was more experienced, came in. And as I understand it, she was told to go to the site where the body was found, talk to some of the neighbors, and fill out the story, and then they added a map. And I just went on to other duties. I actually covered an air show that day, because it was just part of the general assignment.
There wouldn't be another full story on Diane's unsolved murder for nearly 17 years. In January 1998, Hamilton Wentworth Regional Police, as it was then called, held a press conference. Detectives were asking the public to help them find the Ravine Rapist, a serial predator whom they believed was responsible for 9 vicious sexual assaults and Diane's murder. That's when Barbara Brown, the Spectator's now retired court reporter, picked up the case.
Well, it was the talk of the towns, and particularly in Stony Creek and DeFasco, that the police were playing. They had a hotline for the 911 call that came in several days after the murder of Diane Wurundowicz, and they were asking people if they recognized this voice.
Emergency Bureau.
This police?
Yes.
I got information on how that girl was killed in Barton and Lake.
What's your name?
It's not important.
Okay, what's the information?
She was raped before she was killed. She was wearing blue jeans, a white top, and a red or orange top over top of the white top. Blonde hair, about 5'11". She was found face down in the creek with a tire on top of her shoulders and head.
Yeah.
And that's about all I can tell you. And she was strangled with her purse.
Again. Can you give us any more?
No, I don't want to get involved.
Well, why are you bother calling then?
In that recording, you can hear the caller hang up, then pick up the receiver again to say, and she was strangled with her purse. You can also hear the frustrated police officer phone the anonymous caller back.
It was a big thing. It was a big to-do. Everyone was talking about it at DeFasco. And this was making Robert Badgero very nervous, apparently, from reports that we heard at the trial. One of the things that made him concerned was that he talked to his brother-in-law.
His brother-in-law was Randy Kovacic. At the time, Kovacic was a constable with the Hamilton Police Service. He went on to become a homicide detective.
Everyone was talking about it, and he was getting very edgy and nervous and worried about whether the police were going to be coming for him. And so he had a conversation with his brother-in-law about things that he was worried about. And one of the things that he was worried about was that he had been named as a suspect in the 1981 assault and screwdriver stabbing of a young woman by the name of Debbie Robertson.
7 weeks after Diane's murder, Debbie was attacked in the same neighborhood. She told police her attacker was Robert Badgero. She had gone to Orchard Park High School with him.
She had positively identified him. And unfortunately, the police, after an investigation, felt that her identification evidence was not strong enough to proceed with charges. So, you know, he knew that he was on their radar. Something else that bothered him was this hotline and the 911 recording that came in after the murder of Diane. The telephone booth where it apparently came from was just meters outside his workstation, where he worked at number 6 gate in the number 1 Hotmail at DeFasco on Ottawa Street North. And so that was making him feel uneasy, you know, that he was so close to that place that was the source of the 911 call. And he also knew from the Ravine Task Force that police were indicating that they had new DNA evidence. Now, this was something that back in 1981, when this murder happened, that DNA was not commonly used in murder trials. It wasn't until the early 90s that this became a regular method of identifying perpetrators of sexual assault. And so he went to his brother-in-law and he spoke about all of these things. And then he told Randy Kovacic, who was a police officer, a constable, that this strange story about him being at Malarkey's bar in Stony Creek one night years ago and having consensual sex with a young woman in the back of his car. And he said to Officer Kovacic, or his brother-in-law, what if that was Diane Wierendowicz, the woman that was murdered? And his brother-in-law said to him, well, if that's true, you're just about the unluckiest guy in the world.
On December 1st, 1998, at about 6:30 p.m., 40-year-old steelworker Robert Badgerow was driving through the intersection of Lake Avenue and Delawana Drive, past the very spot where Diane was likely dragged into the ravine on the last night of her life. Badgerow was married to Cheryl. They had three boys, an 8-year-old and 6-year-old twins. The family lived a seemingly ordinary life on Walker Avenue in Stony Creek. Badgerow later described his arrest to a jury. I had officers all around my car pointing their guns at me. I was terrified looking down the barrels of those guns, and everybody shouting a different order. I didn't know what to do at first. Badgerow was arrested and charged with the rape and first-degree murder of Diane Wierendowicz and the attempted murder of Debbie Robertson. He has never been charged with any of the other ravine rapist attacks. They remain unsolved. Next time on Covering Diane.
Ridiculously unrealistic. I mean, the chances of Robert Badgerow having consensual sex with a stranger, with a woman, who then is murdered by someone else on her walk home. And then that 911 call just happens to come from, or appears to have come from, a phone booth meters away from where Robert Badgerow is working his shift at DeFasco. I mean, it just, you know, it's mathematically impossible for all of that to come together.
Covering Diane is a serial podcast produced by David Crosby and Susan Claremont at the Hamilton Spectator.